Tonight we are delighted to have with us the great couple of archaeology, Shari Stoker and Jack Davis, both CYA friends, I think, and Jack is also a member of our board of advisors. We are particularly excited tonight's lecture, as tonight's lecture comes right after the publicity and the publication of the remarkable Pylos Combat Agate, the stunning seal whose image impressed us all, impressed everybody around the world, with its high aesthetics as it depicts two warriors in a hand-to-hand battle. The seal is one of the most significant finds, maybe there will be more, I hope there will be more, to emerge from the intact grave of the griffin warrior of Pylos, which is one of the most spectacular archaeological discoveries of recent years. It was uncovered in an olive grove in the city of Pylos in 2015 by Shari and Jack, who have been excavating there for the last 25 years, I believe. Last summer, CYA gave a stipend, a scholarship to a CYA student to work as an apprentice, and we are very grateful that you had this student, Jack, and participate in the excavation. A large number of our students also visited the site during the Peloponnese study tour this fall, and I'm sure many of them are here tonight and they will have some questions to ask. Sharon Stoker holds a PhD from the University of Cincinnati, an archaeologist who has participated in excavations in Greece and in Albania, and she's a senior research associate at the University of Cincinnati. She directs the publication program of the excavations at the Palace of Nestor, and except from Pylos, she has served as co-director of the archaeological surveys in the hinterlands of the Greek colonies of Pydarnos and Apollonia in Albania, and of excavations at the recently discovered Greek sanctuary at Apollonia. From her numerous publications, she and Jack are so prolific that there's an issue here. I can't possibly go into all the publications that they have. But I will only mention the most recent works, which I find. One is called Realizing Consilience, How Better Communication Between Archaeologists, Historians, and Natural Scientists Can Transform the Study of past climate Change in the Mediterranean. That was in 2016. And again in 2016, Mycenaean Hierarchy and Gender Roles, Diet and Health Inequalities in Late Bronze Age. And apparently it is work, not in progress, but in press. And that is Representing in Colors at the Palace of Nestor and Late Bronze Age Tombs at the Palace of Nestor. That was with Jack. Now, Jack Davis is Carl Bleggen Professor of Greek Archaeology at Cincinnati. He holds a PhD from Cincinnati, and he has served on various boards. He was director of the American School of Classical Studies between 2007 and 2012, and I had the great pleasure to work with him when he was chairing the group of American Colleges Association at that time. He served recently in the Advisory Council to the President, the Britannico Symbolio of the University of Athens. That was between 2012 and 2016. I must say here that this was a remarkably interesting and Israeli Greek affairs, and it was a product of the very far-reaching and reform system of the then Minister of Education, Anna Diamantopoulou. We all applauded it at the time. We were happy to see Jack in as one of the members of this Britannico Symbolio, and then all hell broke loose when this government came to power, and this very, very good initiative went, had its demise, let's put it that way.
It was only held hostage for 4 hours.
It has a muscle.
Only for
among
four,
other things.
Only for 4 hours.
Among other things. He is a recipient of many honors and awards, and I will single out one of them, and that is that you apparently became honorary citizen of the municipality of Nestor in 2009. He has directed archaeological regional studies in such places as Kea, in the Nemea Valley, in the hinterlands of the ancient Greek colonies of Dyrrhachio and Epidamnos, and Apollonia, all those in Albania, and of course in the area of the palace of Nestor in Messenia. He's a world authority on Aegean prehistory, and again, the books, the works, the edited volumes are too many. I will only mention the very, very last, most recent publication, a book, the Pylos Regional Archaeological Project, which was edited by John Bennett, and that's a 2017 publication. Nothing more on our remarkable speakers tonight. The floor is yours.
And I'd like to start out by saying that all archaeology is a team effort, and we wouldn't be here without our team in 2015 and the team that we have now. And so although we talk about it, you know, Jack and I are talking about it, it's something that we did together, and we are very grateful to everybody who helped us. And then also I will just point out the wonderful painting by Denitsa Nenava. Many of you know Hussein, and this is his better half, and she's a great artist as well as a wonderful computer scientist. So most of you who are here obviously know where we are. We're in Greece, and we're talking about the southwestern part of Greece, specifically the area around the Palace of Nestor in Messenia. And this is the site of ancient Pylos that we're talking about, but it's located in the modern village of Hora. And so ancient, modern Pylos is actually, this is an image of the best beach. Many of you have probably visited Voidokilia. And this is then, we're at the Palace of Nestor here, and we're looking down towards the sea and the island of Sphacteria. And this is where modern Pylos is located. So the name has migrated since antiquity. And then this is a view towards Mount Aegaleon in the distance, which is a very important boundary between the western part of Messenia and the Kalamata area. And it's very important in the Linear V tablets dividing the provinces, the hither province and the further province. And the Palace of Nestor is in the hither province. And I want to start by telling you a little bit about the palace so that you have the context for our excavation. And then I'm going to tell you about the excavation itself And Jack is going to talk to you about some of the more spectacular finds that we have uncovered. So the palace was excavated by Carl Blagan from the University of Cincinnati. And on the very first day of excavation, in April of 1939, on a dark day, he discovered what became known as the Palace of Nestor. And on that first day, he discovered the archive room and a part of the throne room and a trench that ran all the way across the Acropolis. And here's Carl Blagan and his assistant, Marion Rawson. 1939 was not a good year to start an excavation in Greece, and so they did not come back until 1952. After the Greek Civil War, and from then until shortly before Blagan's death, they continuously excavated. So they stopped in 1969. Here then is the palace under, I'm going to get rid of that arrow, under a beautiful new shelter that was inaugurated in June of 2016. And again, Hussein, I'm grateful to you for your help in the excavation. We were fortunate enough to be able to work with the Archaeological Service to excavate for the foundations for the columns, and we're in the process of publishing that material right now. And we're grateful to the Archaeological Service for allowing us to participate. Here's a wonderful reconstruction that they did of the palace itself that shows you the throne room, and then the highly decorated floors, and then the walls are also decorated with wall paintings. Here's the archive room that we talked about that Blagan found on the first day, and then this is the corner of the throne room. And here you can see a reconstruction of the throne room by the very, very famous archaeological illustrator Pete DeYoung, who worked with Blagan, but he also worked with Sir Arthur Evans at Knossos, and then he illustrated in the Agora. I would say that it's a little bit fanciful, a little bit deco maybe, but we do have the wall paintings and the hearth is decorated. So a lot of what Pete DeYoung did is really very true to what actually exists. This then is what the hearth looks like today. The flame pattern, it decorates it. And in areas where the hearth is broken, we can actually see seven successive layers of plaster, mm-hmm. all with the same decoration, but the bottom one has the flames going the other way. Here then are some of the wall paintings, the famous lyre player with the bird that some people interpret as the winged words of the bard, a little griffin actually with the head plume. And then the palace is also known for its bathroom, which is unusual. The Palace of Nestor is the most well-preserved Mycenaean palace that we have today. And the bathroom is one of the, or the bathtub is one of the excellent features, and two large storage jars for water. Here's a close-up of the decoration on the bathtub. So what I wanted to just mention, which many of you know, the archives room was full of linear B tablets. And these were very, very important because they led to the decipherment of the language. And here then are what the linear B tablets look like. They were never meant to be preserved. And of course, they were burned in the fire that destroyed the palace around 1200 BC, 1180 BC, and that's why they're preserved, and they are actually an early form of Greek. Unfortunately, they don't tell us very much about the social life or the beliefs of the people. They're more a laundry list of material, administrative documents that tell us about taxes and those types of things. Here then is a reconstruction of what the archives room might have looked like. And then here is a reconstruction of the whole Acropolis, including the house of the war chief, most likely, which was also highly decorated with wall paintings. And most of those, though, are here, which has Mycenaeans fighting what Blagan termed as Tarzans, people in animal skins. And the Mycenaeans are dressed in the typical battle gear with a boar's tusk helmet and a spear, and then lappets on their skirt and greaves. And this boar's tusk helmet then is important when we come to the Griffin Warrior, which is 200 years earlier, but it's still something, it's the beginning of the boar's tusk helmet. Here then is the new ship wall painting that we published several years ago that was also in the House of the War Chief, and you can see a purple sea, a wine dark sea, and it's a scene of three ships that are moving across the water. And then finally, one more image I'll show you as an advertisement for the many dogs that we have at the Palace of Nestor. We're always looking for homes for our animals. But we have a scene of hunting dogs, and you can see that the modern dogs are very much in line with the Mycenaean ones. So if anybody wants a dog, let me know. I'll be happy to provide you with one. Now, as I said, the Palace of Nestor was destroyed around 1200 BC, and the site, the buildings on the site that you see today are mostly from, they were mostly built around 1300 BC. But we know from the excavation that we just did with the Archaeological Service and from Blagan's excavations that there was an earlier palace. And this was composed in large part of large ashlar blocks. And so this is a reconstructed wall of the current palace, and then these are remnants of the earlier palace. And here then is a mason's mark, and I have it's in the form of a double axe. I don't know if you can make it out with a stem. And this is something that's very common on the island of Crete with the Minoan civilization. And this is important as we start to talk about the Griffin Warrior, because many of the finds from his grave show a very, very strong Minoan influence, or they were themselves made on Crete and brought to the mainland. And so already in a period around 1450 BC, we're seeing a very strong contact, and probably earlier as well. So I'm going to leave the Acropolis now and turn to the burial monuments that are in the vicinity. Here's the palace, and here then is a large communal burial tomb that is near the grave of the Griffin Warrior that was excavated by Carl Blagan himself. And I just want to say, as an aside, this highlighted area is a field that Jack and I have been trying to expropriate since 2006. And if we had had this field in 2015, we would not be here lecturing on the Griffin Warrior, because the Griffin Warrior was Plan B. So Plan A was to work in this field, and we're fortunate, I suppose, that didn't come to pass. So here then is what the tomb looked like, the Tholos tomb looked like when Carl Blagan found it. The blocking wall was intact, actually, but the dome itself had collapsed, and it was being used as a modern threshing floor. And this is what it looks like reconstructed today if you go inside. Now, these were used, as I said, for multiple burial, and there are multiple burials. There are between, say, 12 and 14 burials in this particular tomb. And they would have probably been very, very wealthy, but unfortunately, most of them were looted in antiquity. And those that weren't looted in antiquity are often looted today, which is a big, big, big problem in Greece, a very sad problem. It's likely that the looters climbed in through through a space between the top here. They burrowed in. But there was so much loot in there that they left behind many precious objects, including a gold seal with a griffin and a gold signet ring. So this speaks to probably the great wealth that would have been there originally. So here then is the Tholos tomb and the Dromos, leading into it. And here, nearby, is the grave of the Griffin Warrior. So you can see the proximity between And this is what the field looked like when we went to Plan B in 2015. It's an olive grove. There's not much to recommend it, except the palace itself is up here on the Acropolis. And so this field is owned by the Archaeological Service, and Blagan was never able to work in it. He died before he actually had a chance to explore it. This is then the trench. You can see there are five stones that are on the surface. The field supervisor and the field director said, we have stones here, why don't we put a trench? Let's see what comes of it. And by the third day of excavation, we had the entire outline of what turned out to be the grave of the Griffin Warrior. Now, at the time, we had no idea that we would find anything in it because there was no material. There were a few sherds that came up and some very, very small pieces of bronze. And so we assumed that if it were indeed a tomb, it had been looted. But one of the first things that we came upon is a very large stone that was not leaning against a wall, and it proved to be a large hindrance to our excavation because it takes up almost half of the grave. This would have been, we now know, one of the cover slabs for the grave itself, and there would have been probably two others that are now missing that would have covered these ends. So here we are with Flint Dibble, who is the area supervisor, and Allison Fields, who is working in the trench, the trench supervisor. Jack and I were actually at the bank, and this is the 10th day of excavation, and we received an urgent message that said, come quickly, we've hit bronze. And this is how we found Allison and Flint. They're looking like the cats that swallowed the canaries because they're extremely pleased, and it turned out that they had good reason to be very pleased. And Jack and I came, and we actually didn't leave the site until the end of September, except to sleep. We had to go home to sleep. But that was sometimes very, very difficult because of the wonderful things that we found. So here's what then the grave looks like at the beginning of the excavation after we had cleared away the soil. We excavated it in two halves because of the large stone. We weren't able to get to this half initially, and we also had no place to stand because it was so full of objects. But there's wood emerging here, which is very unusual in Greece. Wood is not generally preserved, and a large spouted bowl and some other artifacts. A large basin is coming out here. We're very grateful to our conservators. I'm working with them now, Maria Ntsotsu from the Athenian Agora and Nefeli Theoharous. Nefeli was on a bus when we got the message from Flint and Allison, and I called her on the bus and I said, Nefeli, you need to come back. And she said, oh my gosh, I can't. And I said, please. So she came for a few days, and then Maria came from Athens, and then I had lined up for another conservator to come. His name is Alexandros Zochos, and he has worked on our wall paintings for many years, and I called him in Athens, and I said, Alex, how do you feel about working with bronze? And he said, Sherry, I don't really like to do it. You know, it's not my favorite medium. I'm a wall painting specialist. And I said, well, Alex, could you come and just help us out with a few small pieces of bronze? And he said, for you, yes. So he came and he stayed for 6 months. And all he worked on was bronze. As you can see here, it's full of bronze. I kind of tricked him, but he was a wonderful asset to our team. And then here is an idea. It gives you an idea of the size of the grave. I'm working with Flint's wife, Yonita Martini, and only two people can actually fit in there at the same time. And that's one of the reasons that we went so slowly. But what we found is that the first layer of artifacts, which we have here, consisted almost entirely of bronze. And so these are the spouted basin that we saw, the wood, and the large basin. Our images were created by Denise Nemeva. She did a really great job reconstructing it. We needed to take measurements on everything because we couldn't take it out. We couldn't expose it all at the same time. So Denny has been able to reconstruct it from our GIS points, and we're fortunate for that. This is what it looks like. You can see the mirror coming out. That was originally published when the story broke. Again, the other objects that we've talked about, the stone, here's a close-up of the mirror after partial conservation with rosettes. Finally, in the middle of June, we were able to move the stone with a truck jack, so we had it upright for the remainder of the excavation. And towards the end of June, we found our first gold. Jack didn't spend a lot of time in the trench, but when he did get in, he came up with the first piece of gold, and we had been working there day after day. It was hot. He jumps in and he said, "Oh, look, I found gold." And, you know, he really had. So I don't know. Maybe he brought us good luck, I guess. But here's this is something to remember, because this is one of the first pieces that we found. And unfortunately, that stayed in the grave from the end of May until the middle of September because we could not get it out. And I'll show you why a little bit later. Here's Alex removing the first gold cup. Here is the bottom of the large bronze basin, and it's full of artifacts. We have a bronze double axe, and it's also full of boar's tusks of the type that we saw in the helmet with the wall painting, and pieces of ivory. There are several ivory combs. Here, then, is what the boar's tusk looks like. And again, just to remind you, it was used to create the boar's tusk helmet. We're pretty sure that we have a complete suit of armor in the grave. The problem is that the bronze is in about 10,000 pieces, so it's going to take a while for us to reconstruct it, and also a lot of money. Here's the reconstructed armor from the Vendraw chamber tomb. So we know already from x-rays that we have these pieces, and so this, think of that having been smashed and broken, and it's really quite a nightmare, actually. But it's very exciting. There were about six combs in there, ivory combs. Here it is before conservation. This is after Alex has worked his magic, actually in the grave. We took it out attached to a piece of bronze, the bottom of the basin, because it was impossible to separate them there. So here, then, is the complete first layer of artifacts, and we thought probably that we were at the end, although we had traces of wood coming out. We also have a nice star with bronze star with gold on it. And when we removed that basin, we found again traces of wood, but we also found, beginning to come out here, another layer of artifacts. And this is when we began to find the precious materials. Jack had been asking if we could find a ring for a number of days, and we never did. And then we finally found our first ring, and right after that we found our second ring. And as most of you know, we ended up with four gold rings. And these are some of the seal stones. They're all in close proximity to the warrior's ribs, and this is his arm bone. So we began to uncover his physical remains at this point. So here it is by the middle of August. We have a dagger that's here. We've got a sword with a gold pommel. And we found that there's a large bronze basin with a silver cup inside of it resting on his chest. And you can see his body here. Everything is there, but parts of it have been displaced because when the stone collapsed into the grave, it caused the coffin to collapse, and that brought a great deal of earth into it. One of the strange things we found is this. We couldn't figure out what it was, but upon cleaning, we found that it's a bull's head. You can see his eye and his little nose and mouth here. And it's actually the finial of a staff. And so it's pierced so that it would have been attached to wood, and it probably was like something, the scepter that was passed around in the Iliad and given to whoever was speaking. Agamemnon had one. That's described. Here's the sword. Again, a nightmare to get out because you can see all of the material that was resting on top of it. Each thing needed to be removed before we could actually get down to the sword itself. Now it's been taken out, and I'm showing you this image because One of the most amazing things that we found here under this innocuous piece of silver coming out here is actual remains of textile. These are fibers that are preserved. Usually you only have the metallic residue of them, the pseudomorph, but we actually, because of the quantity of metal, have the fibers preserved, and we've sent them out for carbon 14 dating, AMS dating, and also to learn about the weave and the material, and it's linen. So this is new information that we have about actually the textiles that were being used in the early period. The grape dates to about 1450. I didn't say that, but it's about 250 years earlier than the destruction of the palace that we just talked about. This is then the necklace that I said to keep your eye on. You can see now why we weren't able to take it out. It was looped under a part of the bronze basin that was resting on the warrior's chest. This is why we didn't sleep at night. We had to leave it every time we went home. The thing is approximately this long, and it's solid gold, and we worried about it literally for 3 months. And that in itself is a different story. Here it is, once it's out and cleaned, partially cleaned. It has beautiful agate beads, and this is glass. It probably would have been blue, and it's lost its color. But it's a spectacular piece with a very unusual type of box change that the chain is composed of, and granulated ends. So it's really an exquisite piece of work. So here we are at the end of September. The only thing that remains really are the skull and the pelvis. And we decided, because the soil is solid clay, we decided to take these out in blocks, as you can see here. Anyway, it was certainly a very, very exciting summer, and every day there was something new to find, so it was never boring, but it was certainly exhausting. So here we are, as you might recall, we're getting ready to take the skull and the pelvis out. This is so our physical anthropologists could excavate them in the more controlled environment in our laboratory. But one of the things that we did do was we took them to Kalamata for CAT scans. And the doctors there had never done anything like this before. So they were thrilled to put the skull through into the CAT scan. And this is what the image looks like. There are some gold beads that are left and a part of a silver cup. And here actually is what turned out to be a bronze ring. So the x-ray is really important, and it helped us with the excavation. Quickly, I'm just going to tell you about the construction, and I'm not going to make it turn, but it's fairly simple stones. You saw the large Solos tomb, which is very elaborate. This is made of just field stones, although at the bottom it does have some large ashlar slabs. We excavated on the outside of the grave to see how it was constructed. Here's an example of the types of pottery we found. There's no pottery in it except for very, very small sherds. And to run through it again, we've got the top layer, which consists of all of the bronze. Underneath that, we're getting to the precious objects. We've got the purple and silver, the yellow is gold, and the red is carnelian. So you can see there are a large number of gold beads and carnelian. We also had agate beads, amber beads, amethyst. So it would have been quite a colorful burial. And finally, we're down to just the skeleton with the precious objects in the seal stones. And one of the things that we were able to do from the skull, because we had all of the bones preserved then, is to our physical anthropologist and her colleague made a reconstruction of what the Griffin Warrior probably would have looked like.
I want to say first off, thank God Sherry dug that grave for a couple reasons. One of the major reasons was I couldn't fit it because I was much too big. she's a much better excavator than I am anyway. So the results have really been spectacular. We have, and Sherry didn't mention this, we have how many, 3,000 cataloged entries now of material that has been recovered from the grave. Now, a lot of that, as she said, are fragments of the suit of armor. But a lot of these, well over 1,000, are individual objects. And each one of these objects requires special treatment and conservation. So we're not intentionally teasing you by, you know, doling out a couple objects every year just to keep you excited. It really does take us that long in order to prepare the material properly to make public and for presentation. We're working as fast as we can. And Sherry lives here in Greece, and she works year-round with a team of conservators now in order to further the efforts either in Delos or in the Athenian Agora laboratories. What I want to do today, and I won't pretend to be an expert in any of this, although we've expressed our opinions in press about some of these finds. I certainly don't want to pretend I'm an expert in the Minoan religion when we actually have the expert on Minoan religion here in the room in the first row sitting next to us. But what I want to do briefly is to run through, show you some of the finds that we published last year and what they represent. And then I'll come to the finds that we've just published, that the publication just appeared last week to an academic audience. And you have seen some of this in the newspapers, but you certainly won't have seen all of it unless you saw the academic publication. So let's start with the gold rings that Sherry mentioned, the four gold rings that we discovered. And you can see where they are located. They're the yellow, big yellow circles here on top of the skeleton of the Griffin Warrior. And they, along with seal stones, they're really two groups of seal stones, mostly on the Griffin Warrior's right side, but another small group off his left shoulder. And we have, 55 or so seal stones, which is the most that's ever been found with a single burial in Greece up until this day. There is a case of four gold rings, but on Crete, not on the Greek mainland. And we have these little mini pictures of the four gold rings around the side. But the most spectacular of the gold rings is this scene, which many people have said to us that if this had been found to come to the antiquities market, almost certainly there would be many scholars who have said it was a fake. It's not a fake. You saw it in the ground, part of it. And I sat patiently day after day saying, Sherry, please take it out today. And she said, I can't get it out. It's too tight. It's wedged in between something else. But eventually when it came out, it's the second largest gold ring ever found in Greece. It's just a little bit smaller than the gold ring, the famous Tiryns gold ring from the Tiryns treasure that was discovered a very, very long time ago at the beginning of the 20th century. And what we have is a scene of Minoan cult. It's a seaside scene, this net pattern representing the sea. There's a little inlet here with a lot of rocks around it. And there are palm trees on either side flanking a shrine. And there's a tree coming out of the top of the shrine. Now, I'm sure I know lots of people have expressed opinions already about what kind of tree that is. The leaves look very ivy-like, and I'll leave it at that. We may be on an island here, since there's rock work around the top of the composition, too. And we've got two groups of women, three women on this side who we think are dancing, and one is much larger than the other two. And they have scarves, which seem to be suggesting the whirling motion as they dance. They rather look like wings. And on this side, we have two women with kind of high-pointed witch's hats, and they're holding their hands to their mouth. We think they're singing. So this is a scene of dancing and music in association with the cult, we think, of the goddess, who is this large woman in the center. Now, one reason this might people might have thought it was a fake, is that you can find little bits of this composition in other places. There are there is a seal impression, an impression of a seal from southern Crete, from Aia Creata, that has these ladies on it. There's, of course, the palm trees. The way that they're arranged is very familiar from the actual throne room of the palace of Minos at Knossos, and so on. So somebody might have said, some wise guy, that a wise lady, that this was a kind of a pastiche that was thrown together by a forger, but it's not. We thought we'd really, well, we were happy with one ring, right? But then they kept coming at us. That's the big ring. We have a couple much smaller rings. These are substantially smaller. This is a 2-centimeter scale along the bottom. Here we have another seemingly a goddess with outstretched arm, and she's carrying a staff like the one that Sherry was referring to before, which has horns on top, and there are birds on either side with their wings still almost as if they've come down from on high to alight on top of the rocks. And she seems to be, because her feet, she's not walking, her feet are down as if she's coming down from the heavens too. That's one of our small rings. One of our medium-sized rings, and then I'll show you another small ring. This is a medium-sized ring. This is a familiar enough scene. We have it on other gold rings and other impressions of seals. But the familiar scene of bull leaf, and that's a particularly good one. Bull leaf are here alighting down behind the bull. But lots of imagery of bulls from this tomb. We have lots of representations on the seals of bulls too. And one of the things that we've noticed as we've proceeded with our studies is that we not only have representations of things, we actually have the physical things in the grave. This is, I think, an observation that has not really been able to be made with any confidence previously from a context, from a Greek burial context, because the big problem is that most graves of this period are multiple burial graves, so the grave goods tend to get mixed up, and you can't sort them out. And then they're pushed to the sides of the tomb, too, when a new burial is made. So we've got the physical bull representation of the bull here in the head of the staff. Fourth ring, small ring, here we have a peculiar scene, again, of a goddess, and she's wearing pants instead. And here the bird is alighting or perched on the back of her throne. This is something that's true of the Tiryns ring, the great Tiryns ring, too. There's a bird on the back of the throne there, too. She's being approached by this lady who's carrying something, again, that looks very horn-like in her hands. Although after we published this, it was suggested to us by a good friend of ours in New York, Bobby Cole, who drew our attention to a hippopotamus horn, a hippopotamus tusk horn, a tooth horn, found in the Uluburun Mycenaean shipwreck off the coast of Turkey. And now we're playing with the idea that we do think this is a horn-ish thing, maybe a musical instrument that's been embellished. And we kind of like Bobby's idea that it's a hippopotamus incisor is what it would be. And the goddess here is holding something that looks like a lollipop in her hand, but that seems to be a mirror, although there are others who have suggested other interpretations since. I think we're going to stick with a mirror for the moment. And we, in fact, have the mirror in the tomb that Sherry showed you again. So what all of this seemed to be adding up for us was the idea began to evolve even as we were moving the objects from the grave, but as we were proceeding more deeply into study, we began to feel that there was nothing really random about the placement of objects in this grave or the choice of objects to include in the grave, as we think everything was pretty carefully thought out and intentional. We think that we would go so far, I think, at this point, to say that we think the people who selected the objects Combat agate has nothing to do with religion, unlike the gold ring, so far as we know. But it's a scene of battle, of combat, and thus it has its name. We've known about scenes of combat for a very long time, since Heinrich Schliemann excavated the grave circle, now grave circle A at Mycenae. And two of the most famous representations that he discovered, I show you here on the screen. Both of these are in the National Museum at Athens, and you can go there and see them. The one on the left is the so-called Battle in the Glen. All dissertations have been written just about that gold seal, and this is a gold seal too. These are both of gold. But notice that in both cases we have an heroic figure who has very little armament here and here, and he's in both cases jamming a sword, in this case behind the shield of this warrior, so as to cut his jugular as it pierces their necks. Now, the other thing I want you to notice, although these have been hailed as great works of Mycenaean art, they're really pretty crappy as works of art compared to what we've discovered, or fortunate to discover, in the grave of the Griffin Warrior. One more scene of combat before we go there, then. This is the newly restored silver battle crater that's also from Schliemann's excavations at Mycenae on display in the National Museum in Athens. You can't see much of the decoration here, but in this rollout drawing done by an Austrian scholar, Fritz Glockholmer, you can see it better. He thinks, though, this is actually can be represented in three dimensions. If you figure out which figures are overlapping, which figures. And he thinks this is a series of duels on a battlefield. It's not the chaotic melee that it appears to be on first glance. But again, the figures here are pretty schematically represented, but again, they have a variety of armaments, in this case a bow or spears, and these oxhide shields. Now, that brings us to the combat agate. This drawing that you see, and has appeared in the newspapers, took over a year to produce. And we're enormously grateful to our staff artist, Tina Ross, who is Canadian, who worked with us, that's a good thing, and worked with us back and forth and back and forth and back and forth in order to achieve this drawing. And what was so difficult about it all is some of the details here are less than one-tenth of a millimeter. Not of a centimeter, but one-tenth of a millimeter. We had to use every technique at our disposal, all the microscopes, all the close-up camera possibilities that we had, in order to get the image captured in this particular drawing. So what do we have here? Again, we have a battle scene, but it's a very elaborate one. We have just one warrior on the ground. That kind of spasmodic poise is something that's known from elsewhere in Mycenaean art. Our friend Livia Morgan has written about it. But this figure is particularly well represented. We have a very triangular composition. The triangular composition is emphasized by the spread legs of this fellow, who in this case, again, is that heroic figure. And again, he's plunging his sword into the neck of this guy. He's actually coming in over his shoulder. You're seeing his back, this warrior's back. So the sword's coming in over his shoulder in order to pierce his jugular. He's wearing a helmet. He's carrying the shield. I'll come back to why the shield's kind of funny looking in a moment. And the warrior himself is wearing very, very little, other than a loincloth, which I'll show you a close-up detail of in a moment. The warrior's opponents are both wearing kilts. We've had so much reaction to the newspaper articles here. Weekly, who wanted me to confirm that this was the earliest representation of a kilt and of the tartan kilt ever known. And he wanted me to explain how kilts then managed to make it into early Mycenaean Greece. I didn't see whether that article ever appeared in the newspaper or not.
Okay, keep in mind here, this is 4 centimeters long. So the whole width, this is 3.7 centimeters from this side to the other. This is the top surface of the seal. This is the side view. It has facets here on the sides. And this is the bottom view. It's very elegant. And at some point, somebody added gold caps with these little gold beads around the edge of the oval caps that were fastened onto the end of the seal, onto the end of a bronze bar, not a gold bar, even though they obviously had a lot of gold around. There's a parallel for this. We discovered last from the site of Nicoria near Kalamata for the use of a bronze bar. Now, again, this is the sort of thing that you might have thought was a fake and come out into the antiquities market. In fact, the first time I saw it, I thought, boy, this really reminds me of drawings commissioned by Walter Leaf for his edition of the Iliad at the beginning of the 20th century. And I showed them to you here. It's remarkably similar. But again, we found it in the ground. Here it is. This is the label for it. It was our level 18 item 112 in that level. It was cemented into the rock-hard clay. I saw some references on the internet, people suggesting maybe it just kind of fell in there later. It didn't. Impossible. And here is where it was positioned relative to all of those seals on the right side of the body of the deceased. When we first brought it out of the grave, this is what it looked like. And it was entirely coated with cemented lime incrustation. And this photograph was snapped by Alexander Zokos, our conservator that Sherry showed you, before, as a good conservator, he has to document the original condition of an object before he begins work on it. This is what it looked like at that point. And this is what it looks like in reality after cleaning. Now, a couple points to point out here. I also saw there's been a lot of mistaken impressions about the color of this on the internet. I've seen it described as black agate. It's not. It's a really beautiful gray banded agate, gray and brown agate. This is the actual natural color. And one thing that's curious here is that it's really hard to see the decoration on the face of the stone. It's almost as if they chose the perfect stone to not allow you to see it. And here's the backside of it again. You can see the really lovely veining. There's a little bit of corrosion product from that iron, from that bronze bar on the side. The gold caps were just held in position by the soil, and they fell off because the bronze had eroded. And here's a side view of the stone. The thing to note here is just how deep the incision is. It took an entire week for another of our conservators, Kathy Hall, to make a proper impression of this seal because of the depth of the incision. Now, this is the one we've released to the press. This has been altered, the color, by the photographer who produced all of these drawings, all of these photographs, in order to de-accentuate the colors of the agate and to bring out the details of the stone. So perhaps you can see a little bit better here. One thing that is interesting here is, like the gold seals from the Schliemann grave, the warrior really seems to be progressing from the left, not from the right, as in the drawing that I showed you before. Normally, in the impression rather than as they appear on the face of the stone. But if you do that, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because in this case, everybody becomes left-handed. And unless we imagine that all on the battlefield really were left-handed, which is entirely unlikely, we have to revert to the notion that the artist who represented this on the face of the seal was thinking of a composition that of the sort that he represented on the face of the shield. He wasn't thinking about the composition as it would appear in the impression. With a couple exceptions, though. Because the midrib of the shield here is, it doesn't really look like you'd expect to have the indentation of a figure of eight shield, even as in Walter Lee's drawings for his production of the Iliad. It doesn't go in, it sticks out. It's a really high ridge. And the reason that he seems to have done that and to have altered a couple features was to make it so that when it did appear in the impression, it would look more like a figure of eight shield. So here you actually have the deep impression separating the two lobes of the shield that the defeated warrior was carrying. So it just took us months and months and months of looking at the details of this before we felt that we were coming to an understanding. And this is the impression that Kathy Hall made after a week. So when we published this in a scientific context, we chose to present it this way, irrespective of the conventions of the corpus of Mycenaean and Mycenaean seals. It's a very complicated scene, although it looks rather simple. Look at some of the details here. The warrior, the spasmodic warrior down here, there's some landscape here. It's as if his hand is reaching down a slope. And it rests on top of a sword, which is a horn sword, which is a particular sword type. Sword here too has a big central groove. It's kind of hard to tell whether it had horns or not, or whether it just wasn't distinguished because of his hand. Interestingly, we have this helmet on that silver battle crater that I showed you. The number of the people there are wearing that kind of helmet, but nobody's really understood what this helmet is made of. But here we see for the first time somebody grabbing that helmet. It's, some people have suggested it's bone. Well, his hand would really be hurting if he were trying to compress a bone, a crest on a helmet. So that's not what we think it is at all. We think it's a pliable material, but also a material that would stand stiff, not like horsehair, which would flop over. This down here is a representation of the sheath of the sword. We have so few representations of sheaths. One of the Theros frescoes, one of the represents a sheath. And this is the hero's sheath here. And there are elaborate cords represented here too. These are little papyrus head finials that are tied onto the cord. I'll show you a close up of his hair, because there we have some really exquisite representations too of adornment. And he's wearing a lot of jewelry. He's wearing a double necklace, maybe like the necklace deposited in our grid. Maybe again, this is a case of an iconographic representation and a physical object. He's wearing bracelets. One of the bracelets has a seal on it, and you can actually see the depression where the decoration of the seal would have been. And again, we're talking here in tenths of millimeters. The detail is such. So let's show you a couple close-up scenes of what I've talking about it. Another amazing feature here is the extent to which the artist has gone to represent the musculature of the human body. We looked at this with some care, and it's incredible how the movement, the representation of the musculature corresponds to the movement of the human form in a very realistic way. There's been a lot of observation of the male body in movement by the person who executed this work. His curly hair, you can see just beneath his arm here are cords coming down. These seem to be the ends of his necklace, and these have beads attached to them, kind of conule in a Mycenaean context, but those are found in Crete, made of steatite. So something like that attached to the end of his necklace, we think. Even the iris of his eye, the pupil of his eye there is represented, again, in microscopic scale. Now, I'll show you another couple of details of the representation. So here we're looking at the the penis sheath that's attached to his kilt. Again, that's something that's very familiar from Minoan art and also representations of Aegean figures in Egypt. But again, very elegantly done. The back of the hair flowing on behind gives a sense of movement to the composition in the same way that those flowing scarves on the gold rings gave a sense of movement to that composition too. And here you see the beads again, just so you can get located. And the head of the spear. These are represented in such detail that you can actually go in the library and pick up the standard work on things like spears and swords and identify and relate the iconography to the real objects that have been found at other archaeological sites, mostly in burial contexts. Now, show you a couple more close-up details. Again, back to the composition. Here we're going to look at the crest and the helmet. We've got some hints of metal helmets. There was a metal helmet found near the palace of Minos at Knossos in the head of the Peritos Valley. We think this is a metal helmet, and it's got decoration. It's like a devolved argonaut. It's very close to a motif that we find in the so-called Ephorian pottery style in late Minoan II and LH2A decoration on the side of this helmet. And here again, you can see how the warrior's hand compresses the crest. This is the crest springs up from the front of that helmet. And here's the seal on his wrist and the bracelets behind. He has a very light beard, and there's a neck guard on the back of the helmet. Now, we've reached the conclusion that helmet crest is made of the hairs, particularly the neck hairs of wild boars. And I went so far as to buy them. They're available on Etsy and various other places on the internet because fishermen use them for fly fishing to construct lures. And I can tell you that they're exactly the right size on the back of a wild boar's neck. They're about this high. And if you treat this as a realistic representation of the helmet, you can actually measure them versus the other parts of the warrior's body. And you come up with a crest of about this height. And they stand stiff, yet you can compress them when you grab them. And I think that's probably the best solution. We've got wild boars all over America now. One just killed somebody in the south. And I know we've got them all over the place now in Greece, so we have lots of wild boar restaurants. But referring back to the boar's tusks that Sherry saw, there we've got boar's tusks for a helmet for a piece of warfare. Now we've got other parts of the boar being used in armament. And that might remind us of a bronze weapon found.
slopes of Mount Yuktos in Crete by Efi and Yanni Sakalarakis, which has a wild boar's head on the blade of a dagger that was used, they thought, in the sacrificial ritual in their shrine at Anamospelia. So boars all over the place here. Back to this drawing again. Sorry, I can't remember what I'm showing you the close-up of. So now I'm going to show you a close-up of the fallen warrior that closes in that triangular composition on the ground. And this is one of the most elegant parts of the composition. You even have the fingernails represented on the hand. And the hair, the back view of the head. Some of the aspects here, this is clearly Minoan art, but some of these details are things that you don't find for another 1,000 years in Greek art. I think that's what makes it so unusual. They must have existed in Minoan art. I can't believe that this is unique, but we just don't have them preserved. The question is, where would they have existed elsewhere in Minoan art? One place that they might have existed is in stucco painting in Crete, particularly at Knossos. And that's an idea that, again, the Austrian prehistorian, art historian Fritz Blockhomer has developed. And we're inclined to think that he's on the right track there. We've come to the conclusion at the end of the paper that we just published that the Griffin warrior wanted to represent himself as an heroic figure. And so much of what was chosen to put in his grave points in that direction. I'll show you one example, which we actually haven't cleaned this yet. I keep saying to Sherry, please clean this. I want to see it. But this is the gold, the sword, the bronze sword with the gold head. And see again, it has the two horns. This is a spectacular thing. And it's manufactured in a technique that some of our colleagues have called chrysokendima, gold embroidery, Mycenaean gold embroidery. But it's not like Byzantine gold embroidery. This consists of making thousands of little gold staples, and they're pressed into a background of wood or ivory that's been coated with will have a coating on top that's a more pliant material into which they're set. And then after these thousands of little staples are set in place, they're burnished and polished so as to appear as a continuous surface. And then on top of all of that, design was engraved. So I want to see what the engraved design is on this. If you look close here, you can see some of those little staples where they've come out. But even the whole pommel of the sword was constructed like that. Before the excavation of this grave, we only knew of 3 examples elsewhere, and they were all in the Argolid. Now we have 2 more from Delos. So, this is Heinrich Schliemann, which I wanted to read you. When he found that nice gold ring and that other gold stamp seal, this is what he wrote. He said, the author of the Iliad and the Odyssey cannot but have been born and educated amongst a civilization that was able to produce works like this. Only a poet who had objects of art like these continually before his eyes could compose those divine poems. It's a great quote. Now, we're not going to say that we actually have representations from Homer, that this is a Homeric battle composition. But we do think that tales that eventually were incorporated into the Homeric poems were already being told in this period, well before the time of the Mycenaean palaces proper. And they may well, some of them, have arisen in the Minoan civilization on Crete. Tales of warriors, single combats, of sacking of cities,
chose to represent the figures in that particular composition in a way that was familiar to him, as warriors appeared in his own day. As, for instance, and that's the point of this drawing, as medieval artists chose to represent the Trojan War in their day, as knights, and as a medieval city. Every age has reinterpreted these tales and transferred them into their own iconographical forms. Now, back to the Griffin Warrior himself and this wonderful reconstruction that was done by our colleagues in Johannesburg in South Africa. Now you can see, and we hinted a long time ago, that there was a reason that we gave him long hair. And the reason we gave him long hair was that we knew that the warrior on the combat agate had long hair. And not only that, but because of the large numbers of combs, Sherry already said a half a dozen combs found in the grave, and we were tempted to say that these combs were included in male warrior burials in accordance with a kind of ritual or custom like that of the later Spartans, which involved repairing one's hair and combing one's hair in preparation for burial, or for warfare, sorry, not for burial. But here, as an heroic figure, he's being buried as a warrior. And it would be appropriate to bury him with a mirror and also with these combs, as he was. In conclusion, I just want to thank the many, many people that Sherry alluded to before in the Ministry of Culture of Greece, the administration, the American School, in the Research Center in East Crete. We could not have done any of this without them. People in the various museums in the municipality of Pylos and Nestor, our many institutional sponsors. This is very expensive business, especially the conservation. And if there's anybody out there tonight that would like to write a check for $500,000, we'd be very happy to accept it from you. These are some people who have given us less than $500,000, but you could be at the top of this list. Dozens of scientific collaborators. You'll see a mix of names here. We have people on our project from 20 different nationalities, from Brazil on the one end to Turkey on the other. About half of the people we work with are Greek and based here in Athens. And our senior staff comes from, again, a wide number of nationalities. Especially at CYA's, yours and ours, resident Turk, Hüseyin Öztürk, trying to pronounce his name correctly, together with our Epimeletri of Antiquities, Lisa Malapani from Kalamata, at the site more recently, just last summer. If you want to learn more, see more pictures, we're just now updating our website. This is how you get to it, griffinwarrior.org. Encourage you to do that. You can follow all of our ongoing developments at the Facebook site that's linked to this. Thank you very much for your attention.
In the Near East about the storm god right, Chef, then?
So I think there is a lot for us to think about, but I tend to, having seen your ring, I think that's what it is.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just out of curiosity, I would like to know, does it make part of the more extensive group of tombs, like, we say, Circle A in Masonry, for example?
No, we have done magnetometry and resistivity, ground penetrating radar, and there are no other tubes in this area. So we've checked it. We've done all of the possible scientific techniques to locate that, as well as test trenches down the field. So it seems to be a solo.
Yeah, we also are not entirely sure what we do with another one.
That's too much.
What better evidence, Jack, for my theory about blue-haired, blonde-eyed invaders from the north than those Scottish Celts?
I'll give your name to that guy. Sporting news. Or not know the next time she visits Scotland.
My name's a colorful.
Some very fine bronze tools. And also evidence for emery from Naxos used as an abrasive in this. But you know, there are 10,000, 11,000 seals known from prehistoric Greece, and we're hardly experts. And there are people who are, but nonetheless. Nobody really quite understands the techniques of the manufacture of these seals, especially one with as much detail as this. There was a paper published in 1977 by Yannis Sakellarakis, who argued that there were a number of crystals that were used for magnification from various sites on Crete. But 10 years later, Dimitris Blantsos published a paper which he argued, I think rather convincingly, that you could not have used those really as magnifying glasses. We've got a lot to learn. On Friday, we're actually going to a workshop of a craftsman who's been involved in reproducing a number of objects in the National Museum. Right. And this is what
we're in
gold and stone. We're going to be talking to them about some of these issues.
Hi, what would you say about a female being depicted in a warrior's grave, especially with those signatures, like a mother goddess figure? Do you think that's of any importance, or has this been found elsewhere?
Well, yeah, I think that it probably is an indicate. Well, first of all, it's probably an indication of some type of a shared religion between the Minoans and the Mycenaeans at this time, rather than separate things that are going on. But I think that he was buried with things that were important to him, both symbolically and artistically. And so, if there was a strong belief at that time in the mother goddess, but in a type of goddess figure, then you would expect to find it in the grave with him. So I don't think it's at all unusual that there are representations of females and males in his grave.
It's very important that in this case we know the sex. We know the sex and the age of the Griffith warrior. We know it. We know it definitely was a man, and we know he was about 35 years old. Because in one of the other most interesting contexts from this period, well, there are a number, from Rootsy, that your father is But one from Baphio, south of Sparta, there's no body.
Yeah.
So we don't know who was in that grave because it was excavated by Christos Absundas at the end of the 19th century. And he didn't find the body. Either it disintegrated or something happened to him by the time he opened the grave. So it's, you might have thought on the basis of some of the finds in this grave that it was a female burial, but we know it's not. And some conclusions reached by Kostas Paskalidis in the National Museum in Athens, he's actually demonstrated that there's a very strong correlation between combs and some of the and mirrors and male warrior burials, which is counterintuitive to what one might first think.
The men like to look at themselves in mirrors too and comb their hair, so I don't think it's that strange.
Sure.
I have an idea about
Actually, it looks a lot like John Pavlopoulos, if any of you know, have seen him recently.
Yeah, he looks like a rock star.
He looks like a rock star, yeah.
I was going to say very briefly about the mirror, that it may not be what we think. In other words, a mirror is a way to look at yourself and beautify yourself, but it's also a way to capture the sunlight. And I've gotten this idea from Egypt. Egyptian tombs invariably have mirrors, and there we know, because we have texts, that this is to capture the sunlight. It may have to do with that.
Sure.
Well, that's really interesting. And I think maybe eventually we'll have some more to say on that subject, on some of the sun symbols.
Right.
stay tuned.
What is the origin of the gold, please? Where did they find it?
Of the gold?
Yeah.
We don't. The
there's gold in Egypt in the eastern desert.
Yeah.
But we're actually working on that through scientific methods. We have something that's called a scanning XRF that can detect very, very small trace element impurities that are in the surface of the gold that you can't remove, that should be able to help us determine where exactly it comes from. So there are multiple sources, as Jack was saying, but we want to be precise.
Even in lottery, there's gold with the silver. But there's been, as you can imagine, most techniques up until now have been destructive. And there's been very little opportunity to actually sample gold objects in Greece. So those that have been studied have been in the British Museum or someplace else out of Greece. Now we can do it with non-destructive techniques.
Hello. Firstly, thank you for the wonderful presentation. It was quite interesting. My question is there any evidence to determine whether or not this burial was something of a public event or a more private event? It seems as though that the number of dormants in this grave suggests that either this person was a very wealthy individual or that he had such a status in the public that they felt that he was worthy of these prizes.
And I think that we believe, and it's generally thought, that these would have been very, very public displays, that people would have been witnessed the elaborate burial with the grave goods, that it would have been a show of his power in life and who he was and what he represented in society. And I think that you could see that also probably in the Tholos tomb with the large dromos that would have enabled people to watch what was taking place inside. So I think public event rather than a private funeral.
Yeah, one more point on this. You can see we've got a bull on here that's tied up, and there's a stew pot next to him. There's some evidence that there was dining that went on in association with this burial, because we found fragments of cook pot, like a tripod cook pot, that were wedged into the interior walls of the grave. We didn't find any animal bones, but there were something was going to be eaten in that pot, cooked in that pot.
that. But unless it was a bad one, we probably wouldn't be able to tell, because diseases don't leave any trace really in the skeleton. And she's examined the skull and did the facial reconstruction, so it certainly wasn't a wound to his head. So as of now, we don't know, and we might not be able to determine it.
We have currently in Cambridge, Cambridge, England, the real one, there's in and out. A team is analyzing the soil from the abdominal cavity, and they're trying to find parasites. And they've been, this same team has been pretty successful finding parasites in British burials. And they've even found parasites in Neolithic burials from the island of Kea. So we're hopeful, and they promised us a report by Christmas, which gives them another week to produce it.
Why was the grave not looted?
The grave probably wasn't looted because it filled with soil. When the stone collapsed, it allowed for the erosion to come in, and so it would have been it wouldn't have been as prominent as the landscape. And by the later period, they would have gone, we believe, for the Tholos tomb, which was a very obvious target for looting. And so it's probably that it passed out of memory somehow. It wasn't visible in the landscape, and they had a much larger target.
And we're getting to the point now where we can, I think, prove that the grave was filled in, that the roof collapsed very quickly, not long after the burial. Shaft was filled in with earth. And a number of threads of evidence are coming together very nicely.
Very well.
Our excavation, our observations, worked by Takis Karkanas here in Athens in the Wiener Lab of the American School, and Christina Margariti, using the scanning electron microscope, looking at cloth remains. And I think everybody's coming to the same conclusion.
With all the Minoan iconography found within the tomb, would you consider this indicative of the art at the time, or as a appreciation of Minoan art and culture as a show of wealth, or even do you think it could indicate economic and political connections between Crete and the Pelian Kingdom?
I think all of the above. I think you did a nice job of outlining. Outlining the possibilities. Like all that's going on. The more we're coming to understand the early history of the site that's beneath the later Mycenaean palace, the more we're seeing just how Minoan, we're not saying it is, that they were Minoans,
but just
how close the ties were.
Absolutely.
And much of this has come out of the excavations that Sherry mentioned for the roof, which she participated in with the Kalamata Ephoria. There's a lot of new evidence there. Especially in masonry techniques
stone
working,
yeah,
and pottery crafts, even wall paintings. I knew you wouldn't.
Thank you for fabulous presentation. Earlier mentioned that perhaps the scene depicted, the hero could be representative of the Griffin warrior himself. Can you speak about that in reference to the other very similar motifs that you included pictures of earlier in the presentation?
If that's what I said, it really should be the opposite. We said that the Griffin warrior is emulating the figure represented in the iconography, not that it is a representation, not that the iconography is a representation of the Griffin warrior.
Sorry.
Any more?
I'm curious about the area where the two
question. And you can see here that they're coming out of the gate. I mean, this is a fairly, the reconstruction is as accurate as it can be. And the gate would have gone directly to Thelma's Four. Okay? So this is slightly off. We've done a lot of test trenching in the field, and most of it appears to be right at the it's the ground level, it's the erosion. We have the stairwell right at the top. But we've also excavated in front of Thelma's Four and for the past 3 years. And we have come up with what looks like some type of a religious complex that's slightly off to the side of the tholos, but it has a lot of figurines, more figurines than Blagan found in this entire excavation on the Acropolis, and it has a lot of highly decorated pottery as well. And so there's some type of possibly religious use associated. It's later in date, though. It's not as late as the final palace period, but it's later than the Griffin. And then there's some other indications that that there might be some type of sacred demarcation that's closer to the wall. And so it might have been some type of burial landscape. But there aren't any more graves.
Well, I think I echo the general feeling here if I say that this is a fascinating presentation. We feel privileged to be part of this. And we wish you more. And as a small token of our appreciation, we want to give you the CYA owl, not in agate, not in amethyst, but in clay, done by ceramist in Paris.